welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 7th of June 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the start of another week, and we've got another exciting podcast for you, and of course I am joined by my co-host from Western Spring, Mr. Max Masson. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, good afternoon to you. Yes, I'm relieved, I think, that gradually now the lockdown is starting to be lifted, and I've had some of the first visitors to my house in quite a long time just recently. Although we didn't go into the house, we stayed in the garden under a gazebo, and so shielded from the rain that was quite torrential. But I think things are from that perspective are starting to look up. And And we do, as you say, have some interesting things to talk about today that relate to politics here in the UK.
I really can't see them keeping the lockdown going for much longer, and it's been a most unexpected reason that is leading to it, and that is the Black Lives Matter insurrection, which has been going on all week. It's going on right now while we are recording this. There are thousands of people, mainly black, in London, ignoring the lockdown rules, ignoring the social distancing rules. If you believe what we've been told by the government, then they are putting everybody else at risk of an increase in the coronavirus. They're putting us all at risk of there being a second wave and us having to be locked down once again. And when they're questioned over this, they're saying, oh yes, but racism is far more important. Racism is more of a risk to the health of black people than coronavirus. And it was only last week that they were telling us that it was all white people's fault that so many of them are dying from this virus. Well, it seems to me that we can see exactly why more black people are dying or catching this virus than anyone else. And it's because they are ignoring the lockdown rules en masse. What do you make of this, Max?
Yeah, I would say that amounts pretty much to self-inflicted injury, doesn't it? If you come from a demographic group that is abnormally affected by coronavirus and you blatantly refuse to abide by the social distancing rules, then really you've only got yourself to blame if you suffer disproportionately from the disease as a result.
And of course, they'll be blaming white people for it. They'll be saying, oh yes, but we had to protest because white people killed this innocent black criminal in America. This black criminal that had done time for armed robbery. I think he'd actually been in prison 5 times. He was on methamphetamine and fentanyl when he was actually arrested. The police officers around him, they weren't white. Although there's a big mural in Ireland which depicts the officers around him as 3 white skinheads. I believe you discovered something else about these police officers that might lead us to having a little bit more understanding for what went on there, Max.
Well, there have been 2 incidents recently involving alleged police brutality in the United States. Obviously, the incident that involved George Floyd, where he died under police restraint. And then there's the incident of the 75-year-old white demonstrator who was attempting to engage with police officers and was pushed over in what appeared to be a rather violent way. An observation I'd like to draw attention to is that in both these cases, the police officers concerned were significantly shorter than the individual they were confronted by. And in the case of George Floyd, they were also considerably lighter in build. In the case of the 75-year-old white man, the video evidence shows that he is head and shoulders taller than the police who are confronting him. And the figures published on the internet that I've seen suggest that George Floyd is at least 6 inches taller than any of the 4 officers involved in his arrest and around 5 stones heavier. Now, I don't want to prejudge any of these cases, whichever way they may be resolved regarding the alleged brutality or otherwise of the police officers involved. But there is a wider issue here that needs to be considered, that of the minimum height requirements and minimum standards generally for police recruitment. In the wider context, there have been a number of complaints made here in the UK and also in other European countries of police being unnecessarily officious, and then becoming aggressive and in some cases violent in enforcing lockdown and also in policing generally in more recent times. But during the 1980s, I considered a career as a police officer, and I applied to a number of police forces to see what would be available there. And in that time, I became aware of the minimum height requirement for police officers. And it was, from my memory, that you had to be at least 5 feet 10 inches tall for most provincial police forces. For metropolitan areas, the height requirement, I think, was 6 foot. And for the City of London Police, it was 6 feet 2. So you had to be, you know, really quite tall to get into the City of London Police. And these height requirements were because there was a belief that officers needed to have a physically imposing stature in order to confidently assert their authority. And this is, again, reflected in the fact that police in those days used to wear the cone-shaped helmets, which were designed to add about an extra 6 inches to their height. And that, again, was to create this sort of imposing physical stature. Generally, therefore, police officers tended to either to be physically larger because of these height requirements, or they at least appeared to be physically larger because they were wearing helmets or whatever, than anyone that they confronted during the performance of their duties. And as a consequence of this, people rarely defied police officers, and police officers felt more confident than otherwise in a confrontational situation, and therefore more relaxed and felt less need to behave aggressively in order to assert their authority. In Western countries around the world, however, these minimum height requirements have in recent times been relaxed, and in extreme cases, such as here in the UK, they've been abolished completely. In Britain, as a result of the McPherson report in 1999, which was to investigate into allegations of racism within the police, the McPherson report recommended that the minimum height requirement be abolished, and subsequently other modifications have been made as well, because it was felt that height requirements and other selective processes tended to select more harshly against ethnic minority candidates than white candidates. And so the entrance exams have been relaxed. And also, it's now possible for people to join the police force who've got criminal records. And so the wholesale lowering of standards that's been done in order to promote diversity makes it introduced in order to make it easier for police forces to recruit from ethnic minorities. But the outcome of all of this is that we now have police officers who are generally smaller than they might otherwise have been, who are in some cases less intelligent than they otherwise would have been, and people who are instinctively less honest than they otherwise might have been. And there's a greater incidence of officers now feeling intimidated, in my view, and nervous when they're required to confront members of the public. And I believe that there is a greater tendency, therefore, for them to behave aggressively in order to compensate for their perceived lack of size and therefore perceived lack of authority. And particularly when the police are confronting large individuals in potentially violent situations, what we now have is a situation where police officers are more likely to draw their guns if they're equipped with guns, or they're more likely to draw their tasers if they're equipped with those. And because they're more likely to draw those weapons, that then makes them more likely to use those weapons. And it makes it more likely for them to be aggressive and to use excessive force when restraining an adversary who is resisting arrest. And you can imagine that the situation in terms of police training, where a trainee police officer will say to an instructor, "Well, you know, I'm quite a small person. You know, what do I have to do when I'm tackling somebody who's 6 foot 6 and 17 stone?" And the kind of advice that they'll get is that they should tackle such a person in groups, that they should offer them less leeway, they should use greater force sooner than they might otherwise have done in order to make sure they get the person on the ground, and once they've got them on the ground, keep them on the ground so they can't get up and use their superior size to get away. And so this has a tremendous impact in terms of police training and in terms of all of their sort of operational methods. However, nowadays, there are black and minority ethnic individuals to be found at all levels in police forces across the Western world. And I don't think it's credible to claim that institutional white racism exists or has any influence on policing methods. Where there are shortcomings on the part of individual police officers and where malpractice is shown to have happened, it's far more likely to have resulted from the lowering of functional competence caused by the lowering of standards introduced to facilitate greater ethnic minority recruitment. It's therefore institutional multiracialism and the institutional drive for diversity that, in my view, is the major cause of police malpractice, not white racism.
And also possibly a reason for why they decided to use that chokehold, because that conferred that extra benefit to them against the size and weight of the potential criminal.
Yes.
I also think that they were probably terrified because that they might end up having to shoot the guy because he was so big. If he resisted arrest, what else are they going to do if they're small? They're going to have to shoot him. So the only thing they can do is try to get him down on the ground where they're not going to be a situation where they're going to have to shoot him. And then rather unwisely, they put him in a chokehold, which seems to have set this off. He was also experiencing a drug overdose at the time and a heart attack. I seem to recall Cresta Dick is rather well known for being vertically challenged. I think she's only about 5'6", and she's leading the Metropolitan Police. So there we have an example of this problem, leading the police force. We have somebody that is only 5'6" and really does not have much of a commanding stature. And we'll hear a little bit more about police women later on. But let's just have a look now at what went on last week. Earlier on in the week, on Wednesday, I believe it was, is when they had the first protest, and this was held in Hyde Park in London, and they had one of the Star Wars actors there, John Boyega, and the news made a big point of the fact that he was in tears at his black brother's dying. But he's an actor; he's paid to be able to cry. That's what he does for his job. I'm certain that those were crocodile tears, and he was talking about how he would never be able to get work again after this. And of course, the truth is the complete opposite. He's now been given lots of offers by various Hollywood moguls. He's been in all the headlines. Then the mainstream media have portrayed this as a really good thing, that all these people are out protesting the racism that goes on and the white supremacy. And it's only last week that they were attacking white people for going out and protesting the lockdown. So it seems that if you're black, you're allowed to go out, you can do whatever you like. If you're white, then you should be arrested and you're going to be called a COVID idiot. Paul Golding tried to arrange a demonstration outside the courthouse a week back, and he was told anybody that turned up would be arrested, and the police did arrest his security team when they turned up around him. So it does seem as if black people can just do whatever they like and white people will be arrested. And then besides that, we've also now got this take the knee situation, where people are being expected to kneel in submission before their new overlords. And last week we actually had images of the police kneeling down in front of the protesters, and then about an hour later they were getting punched in the face by them, and they were getting attacked by them. And this bend the knee thing, this originated with Colin Kaepernick in America refusing to stand for the national anthem. That's what it is. It means that you are refusing to stand for your country. And to try and get police to do that, for a start, it's a political thing. And secondly, it means that they believe their country is a disgrace and they have no loyalty to their country. That is the original symbolism of it. But of course, the immediate symbolism you get from it, the instinctual symbolism, is submission. It's people submitting. It means that our forces of law and order are submitting to the forces of chaos and destruction. And that's, of course, exactly what we saw last week. We saw chaos and destruction. We saw rioting going on. The same things happened overnight. Just last night, we saw that the protesters were all out again, apparently 15,000 of them this time, and we've been told that 1 in 1,000 people have coronavirus. So certainly there will be people that caught it going on this protest last night, but they had to have horses out. And the thing that the BBC is hiding from the viewers is that the protesters, the peaceful protesters, were hurling bicycles at the horses and hurling bottles at the horses. And one of them bolted with a policewoman rider. And as the horse bolted, she hit a road traffic light. She hit the road traffic light at speed and got knocked off the horse and flat out cold on the road. Apparently there were 10 police officers that were injured, and it's still being portrayed as if this was a peaceful protest. It's been going on every day, basically, since Wednesday. It's made a complete mockery of the coronavirus restrictions, where we've got lots of people that are staying in at home, couldn't go to funerals, couldn't go and visit their family, and yet if you're black, you can just go out and riot, and the news will make out that what you're doing is a positive thing. I've got a couple of quotes here also of what actually happened on the Wednesday to the journalists that were trying to report on this. These were both Australian journalists. Two incidents happened. Nine News' Europe correspondent Sophie Walsh was speaking over recorded footage of an earlier protest when she is heard off-screen screaming before the camera returns to Mrs. Walsh, who is visibly upset. When the newscaster sitting in the studio in Adelaide asked Miss Walsh if she was okay, she responded, "A man just came up and grabbed me. He yelled Allah Akbar while making motions to stab her," the network's anchor said, while later reporting on the incident. So there we go. The Australians have got a taste of diversity there in London, a taste of the terrorism that follows along with diversity. And then later on, there was a second attack. Nine News said reporter Ben Avery and his camera operator were ambushed while making a live report. Footage showed the pair being rushed while trying to retreat from danger, and the audio abruptly cutting out as Avery's microphone was stolen. And basically, you've got them being menaced by blacks and then having to run away from them as their equipment is being stolen from them. And this is all being reported on the BBC as peaceful protests. And then again, last night they were outside the Houses of Parliament trying to break in. They were letting fireworks off. There was one instance where part of the outside of the building was almost looked like it was on fire, as if it was about to explode. And you've got a lot of fighting between the police and the protesters. I can't recall any incidents where there was a nationalist protest and it ended up with the protesters fighting with the police. I mean, that just doesn't happen. And yet any nationalist protest is always made out to be violent, and it's always made out to be the fault of the nationalists. And what we see here is the complete opposite. I've got a couple of other things I want to point out, but I'll just pass it back over to you, Max, for your comments on those issues.
Yeah, I think in terms of the violence, it's something. Well, there's something that we've been aware of for a number of years now, which is the existence of Antifa, and the fact that Antifa do employ tactics of terrorism. They come to demonstrations not with the intention of engaging their political opponents in conversation, not with the intention of even just engaging in a competition of who can shout the loudest. Their intention is, when they come to demonstrations, is to disrupt those demonstrations by whatever means necessary. And they come equipped with weapons, and they come with black clothing, with boots, with shin guards, with gum shields, with helmets and protective glasses and things, and their intention is just to attack and do as much physical damage as they can do to people they perceive to be their political enemies. And we can see what's going on in London now, that these demonstrations are being led by the same sort of people that have been leading the demonstrations across the other side of the Atlantic. President Trump has had the sense now to ban Antifa as a terrorist organization, a domestic terrorist organization, but there needs to be a recognition now that it's an international terrorist organization operating in a number of countries, and we need Boris Johnson to ban them as a terrorist organization here in the UK, and then hopefully for other leaders across Europe to do the same thing, because they are a major threat to anybody that is anything other than of the extreme left. But then going back to what you're saying about John Boyega, he's somebody who has been to an acting school, which I think was an acting school that was set up in order to promote actors from, in inverted commas, diverse backgrounds, obviously meaning that they want that the objective of the acting school that he went to was to increase the number of ethnic minority actors that there are. And they certainly succeeded in doing that. And John Boyega is somebody who's benefited from fairly early on in his career getting some very big breaks. And it may well be that he's deserved those big breaks. I don't really want to pass comment on that. But the fact of the matter is that lots of very competent actors spend their entire lives trying to get the kind of big breaks that John Boyega has enjoyed, and because of their circumstances, because they don't know people in the know, they don't know the people that that are the movers and shakers in the world of entertainment, in the world of our mass media, and they never get the recognition that they ought to have, and yet John Boyega has been able to benefit from all of that, and yet he is still making speeches where he's trying to give the impression that there is some serious problem of racial discrimination in this country. Well, you know, somebody who benefits from the kind of opportunities that have been made available to him isn't somebody who lives in a white supremacist state. And it's foolish of anybody to suggest otherwise.
The only oppressed minority in London is white people. Blacks and non-whites make up 60% of the capital city. So how can he claim that he's a minority there? He's an oppressed minority. As you say, he's been given everything on a plate, basically. And also, you've got the case that the protesters have been told to wear masks to protect themselves. I mean, that's an absolute boon for Antifa, isn't it? Because normally they're told they have to remove their masks. So it just means that they're able to carry out lots of crimes, and the chances are that they're not really going to be recognised. Obviously, I would hope that other countries would follow suit with America and declare Antifa to be a terrorist organisation. They are an international terrorist organisation, and the fact that these protests and riots are now taking place in Britain, in France, in Germany, all over Europe, that just proves that it is an international terror organisation. Donald Trump should have clamped down on it when they first started setting fire to things and rioting back on his inauguration day, not let it get to the stage that it's at now, where they have this worldwide movement and they can just basically get away with anything. They've even got support from politicians. On Wednesday, Nicola Sturgeon expressed solidarity with Black Lives Matter protests in the US and backed a call in the Scottish Parliament for the Scots to pay the bail funds for the arrested looters. So we've actually got the Scottish National Party coming out in support of the rioters and looters in Minneapolis and saying that they are going to pay the bail funds for them. I mean, this is a powerful organisation. We're told that white supremacy is the big threat, and there are white supremacist terrorists all around the world just waiting to kill black people. And it's just nonsense. The real terrorist threat here is Antifa and these organized non-white forces that have lawyers to stand up for them. They have rich people like George Soros funding them. They have powerful politicians like Nicola Sturgeon expressing solidarity for them. We've had MPs standing up in Parliament saying Black Lives Matter, as if, which is basically a condemnation of the government itself, implying that according to the government, they don't care about black people, even though they've just done this huge report looking into the causes of why black people are more likely to get this coronavirus. The very fact that they haven't arrested people for going out like they would have done, like they did do for white people going out and breaking the lockdown laws, that shows you that blacks are in this privileged position. They are the elites of our society. They are protected by the law. It took the police themselves two entire days to decide that the protests were actually against the law. On the Wednesday, there was no speech from them. There was no comment by Krista Dick. Sadiq Khan was supporting them and saying that they had a righteous cause and people should be wearing masks. And really, what's happened to London is a really damning indictment on Krista Dick from the Metropolitan Police and Mayor Sadiq Khan, that they just allowed these people to break all the lockdown laws. And I just imagine the faces of Middle England that have not been out for the last 6 weeks, who haven't been able to see their families, and watching all of this going on the television, and then being told that, this is okay because racism is such a problem. This is okay because you're all nasty racists, people that haven't got a racist bones in their body, and we're being told that they've somehow got white privilege, and that they need to be apologising for their white privilege in the way that they've treated blacks. They need to be getting on their knees before these people that are just breaking the law. As I say, they claim racism is a more dangerous epidemic than coronavirus, and that's their reason for protesting. But this happens every time somebody black gets killed by the police, but there's so many white people also get killed by police. The actual statistics in America show that white people are far more likely to be killed by the police than actually blacks are, and blacks are more likely to be killed by black police officers. It doesn't matter what you actually do for these people, it will never be enough. And just to really hammer the point home, the last protest, which took place on Saturday, actually took place on the anniversary of D-Day, and the Abraham Lincoln Memorial was defaced, the Winston Churchill Memorial was defaced, the Cenotaph had Black Lives Matter spray painted on it, and I mentioned about the Cenotaph being vandalized before, and I actually got this a little bit wrong. I saw a circular which actually showed pictures of a memorial in America that had been really badly vandalized, and I mistook that for the Cenotaph, so I have to correct what I said in a previous podcast. But the Cenotaph itself did have Black Lives Matter painted on it, and the BBC and various other organizations have furiously tried to put out counter propaganda saying that it wasn't vandalized, but it was vandalized. It had Black Lives Matter that was painted on it. So they're destroying our memorials in America. They're pulling the memorials down. These people hate us, and what they're asking for is that they don't want any police, basically. They don't want to be prosecuted for breaking the law. In Minneapolis, we've actually got the state governor who is saying, well, the police need to be disbanded, and the police will then look like Somalia, if it doesn't already. Somalia doesn't have a police force, and she's from Somalian origin. But it doesn't matter what we do for these people, they will never be happy. The only solution is that we separate from them. If we separated from them, if we said, you have that land over there, we'll have this land over here, you can have your black teachers, you can have your black police force, you can have your black judges, you can have your black television stations, every single one of the actors can be black, every one of the writers can be black, you can teach your black history in your schools, and we'll teach our white history over here in our schools, and we'll just separate from you. Why is nobody saying that? Why is the whole narrative on the BBC, they say, oh, well, racism isn't a political issue, everybody's against racism. Okay, everyone's against racism. But why are the only solutions to the racist problem that are being put across left-wing cultural Marxist ones? Why are there no nationalists putting across our solutions to the racism problem, which solves all of their problems and all of our problems in one simple to do way? Just separate from them.
Yes, I think I'd wholeheartedly agree with that. Just a couple of things just to pick up on things that you've mentioned as you've been speaking. The taking of the knee by the police is effectively them publicly making a statement that they believe that the state is to blame for there being oppression of black people in this country. And yet police officers are required as part of their job to take swear an oath of allegiance to the state and to the crown. And yet on the other hand, they're going out into the street and they're then taking the knee, which is a statement saying that they believe the state and the crown are racist. And so therefore the police officers that take the knee are effectively revoking their oath of allegiance to the state and to the crown. So perhaps some people within the higher echelons of the police ought to start thinking about that and perhaps taking some action to prevent that kind of abuse taking place. The other thing as well is that we've had with coronavirus, all this whinging and whining about the fact that there seems to be a disparity between the infectiousness of COVID-19, where black and minority ethnic people are concerned, and how perhaps they ought to be recognised as being even braver than the white people who are nurses and doctors and who expose themselves to the viral load as well. But what they forget, and what the people who've been demonstrating in London this week have forgotten in their eagerness to deface war memorials, etc., because there was Black Lives Matter, it was sprayed on the war memorial in the centre of London, and it is that they always claim that the Second World War was fought so that in order to rid the world of racism. I would dispute that, but that's what lefties always claim, that the Second World War was fought to do that, and so that anybody who isn't pro multiracialism is by definition therefore decrying the heroism of the soldiers that fought during the Second World War. Well, the soldiers that fought during the Second World War, the overwhelmingly white soldiers that took part in the first wave landings on D-Day, they were estimated to suffer, and in fact, afterwards they did actually suffer 70% casualties in that invasion, and that's a level of disparity which dwarfs the level of disparity that exists as far as COVID-19 is concerned. And those soldiers, people who promote multiracialism and left-wing ideology in this country believe is true, if those soldiers did go to fight racism, then they went to fight racism and exposed themselves to a danger where they had a 70% chance of dying that day. For people from left-wing circles and people who are promoters of black minority rights in this country, if they cast aspersions upon the state that has resulted from the sacrifice made by those people, then they are in fact insulting the war dead, and in fact, as I said just a few moments ago, they did in fact insult the war dead by spraying Black Lives Matter on our war memorial in the centre of London.
Just imagine if those brave soldiers could see the state of the country today. I don't think they would have gone up the beaches at all. They would have turned their weapons on Winston Churchill or given up fighting. And you can just imagine the coronavirus press conferences now that they have at the end of each day. It's about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the day. We get a coronavirus press conference with one of the MPs comes out and lets us know when the next little bit of the lockdown is going to be lifted. I mean, we're not even supposed to be able to go into shops until July, and here we are with 15,000 people on the streets breaking the lockdown. The police doing nothing about it. Half the MPs pledging their support for this movement, and then are they still going to have these coronavirus talks every day, talking to Middle England, telling them that you know, that they can't leave their houses, or they can only meet up to six people, or not go more than 5 miles from their home, and all these other ideas that they've come out with? I mean, how can they have the front to still come out and do that? We'll just have to wait and see if they do. They probably will. They'll probably try and pretend that this hasn't actually gone on. But I mean, surely they must be embarrassed coming out and saying that stuff, don't you think?
And all the people that campaigned for Dominic Cummings to lose his job because he took his family up to the north of England, where the family home was, in order for them to be safe during the lockdown period. All those people, if they are senior police officers, or if they're politicians who have allowed these demonstrations to take place, then they are guilty of allowing a coach and horses to be driven through the lockdown and social distancing rules. So, you know, whereas Dominic Cummings may have slightly bent the rules, these people have entirely obliterated the rules by allowing these demonstrations to take place. And perhaps they ought to consider resigning in the light of that.
They've lost control of the streets, haven't they? The government have lost control of the streets, basically. I mean, what Donald Trump was saying, you know, you've got to come in with force. You've got to take control. That's perfectly true. You know, what's the word for it? The animals are running the zoo. I mean, that's what's happened.
But lunatics running the asylum.
Lunatics running the asylum. That's the one. Well, we have got a Greatest Britain that we're going to talk about this week as well. And the Greatest Britain this week is Caractacus, King Caractacus. I hope some of our listeners have heard of him. He's a great British hero from the first century. Have you heard of him before, Max? Have you heard of Caractacus or Caradoc at all?
I have. Yes, I have. Although, to be quite honest, up until we started preparing for this particular program, I didn't know a lot about him, to be quite honest. You know, what I would say is that if I don't really know that much about him, then the chances of many other people knowing much about him are going to be fairly slim. So I think we're going to be educating a lot of people here this evening.
Well, it wasn't always like that. Apparently, he was a very famous character, and schoolboys used to be able to actually recite his speech. I mean, he was that famous because he led the British resistance against the Roman invasion, basically. Well, I'll start with a brief outline. Caractacus was a 1st century AD British king of the Cativellani tribe who united and led the British resistance to the Roman aggression. Before the Roman invasion, Caractacus is associated with the expansion of his tribe's territory. His apparent success led to the Roman invasion, nominally in support of his defeated enemies. He resisted the Romans for almost a decade, mixing guerrilla warfare with set-piece battles, but was ultimately unsuccessful in the latter. After his final defeat, he fled to the territory of Queen Cartismandua, who then captured him and handed him over to the Romans. He was sentenced to death as a military prisoner, but made a speech before his execution that persuaded the Emperor Claudius to spare him, which then made him famous throughout the known world. And this Queen Cartismandua, she was actually related to one of the traitors that actually helped Julius Caesar in the first Roman invasion, because this was the second one. The first time Julius Caesar actually came over, he was gone within 3 months, and we basically defeated him, and he had to go back to France with his tail between his legs, and Rome left Britain alone then for about 70 years, I think it was, 50, 70 years, something like that. And then we get this happening again, we get another invasion, and the actual fighting went on for 35 years. And that's something that Britain should be very proud of, the fact that we kept fighting the might of Rome for 35 years, and we defeated Julius Caesar in the first instance. But just to have a look at the references for Caractacus, because we do actually know quite a lot about him, if you think that he's all the way from the first century. The legendary Welsh character Caradoc ap Bran, which means Caradoc son of Bran, and that's Bran the Blessed, and the legendary British king Arviragus may both be based upon Caractacus, as some researchers claim Arviragus was a title for the Pendragon, or High King, rather than a personal name, with the poet Juvenal referring to him as this. And what would happen when Britain was being invaded by foreigners from abroad, all the tribes would nominate one leader to actually lead them, and he was the Pendragon. And Caractacus's speech to Claudius has been a common subject in art and is often referred to when British politicians wish to appeal to the patriotic spirit of the British people. And I've heard Boris Johnson refer to him, and I've also heard Jacob Rees-Mogg refer to him. So he's obviously still taught about in the private schools. It's just that they don't teach the hoi polloi about him. Caractacus's name appears as both Caratacus and Caractacus in manuscripts of Tacitus, and also appears in the manuscripts of Dio. Older reference works tend to favour the spelling Caractacus, but modern scholars agree, based on historical linguistics and source criticism, that the original common Brittonic form was Caratacos, cognate with the Welsh Caradoc, Breton Caradec, and Irish Cartac, meaning long, loving, beloved, dear friend. His fellow countrymen knew him as the praiseworthy opposer, and in more modern times as the patriotic harasser of Rome, and his trial and speech were once familiar to every schoolboy. And I was thinking just before we started here that Fanny Craddock, that the surname Craddock, that probably actually comes from this as well. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
I would certainly agree with you with regard to Fanny Craddock. I would think that name probably comes from that. A lot of these names, actually, well, certainly Caradoc is more familiar to me as a result of studying geology, where that sort of Caradocian series of rock formations are quite famous, and there's something that we'll probably come on to, which is the Silurids or
Silurians. Silurians, I pronounce it as Silurians. The Silurians.
Which again, Silurian is a technical term used in geology as well, and so those words are more familiar to me from that. But I think as far as our resistance to Rome is concerned, the fact that our very ancient ancestors fought so vigorously over such a long period of time is again testament to the fact that we haven't always been a nation that welcomes invaders or that welcomes immigrants. We have been traditionally a nation that has fought to retain control of our homeland, and fought very vigorously and very ferociously for extended periods of time.
Yeah, we were certainly never an easy conquest. The Welsh still honour Caradoc today. They've got, I think it's called Car Caradoc. They've got places that are named after him. He was a very famous king. He's written about in the Triads as well. Well, Caractacus is named by Dio Cassius as a son of the Catavellonian king Cunobelinus, meaning King Belinus, the Cymbeline of Shakespeare. According to the Welsh Triads, Caractacus is known in the Welsh histories as the son of Bran, because Bran is a contraction of Brennan, which was the word for king. Bran the Blessed, meaning the Blessed King. Do you know much about Shakespeare, Max? I guess we should probably do him at some point during this, but have you heard of Cymbeline of Shakespeare?
I'm not a Shakespearean scholar at all, really.
neither am I. I'm not a big fan of Shakespeare, but at some point I think we will have to look at him. Well, based on coins that have been found, and I actually had a look at these coins, and they're beautiful. I think they're first century coins. It's an eagle with a snake in its grasp. And before we were actually conquered by Rome, we had our own coinage. We'd had that for a couple of hundred years, which shows that we had a very developed, civilized system here. And don't forget, we also had 40 different university cities when Julius Caesar first came here. So the fact that we had these coins shows that we had a functioning modern economical system, basically, with the same tokens of exchange that we use today. But based on the coins that have been found, Caractacus appears to have been the protege of his uncle Epitacus, who expanded Catavellonian power westwards, most likely from his palace in Verulam, Herefordshire into the heartland of the Catevallani, which I worked out is North London, and into the territory.
Verulam is Hertfordshire. It's if you go to St Albans, there are the ruins of the old Roman town of Verulam, just on the edge of St Albans.
Yeah, and then he worked his way into the heartland of the Catevallani, which is North London. I'm trying to think of the name of the place there. Colchester.
Colchester.
He made his way into Colchester and into the territory of the Atrebates, who were a Belgic tribe from Gaul that had actually settled around West Sussex. So they'd made their way north, and Epitacus and the Catevallanians, they had made their way into Colchester. And this had upset the tribes that were actually in Colchester, who again were associated with the traitors that had helped Julius Caesar in the first place. But after Epitacus's death, circa 35 AD, Verica regained some territory, but Cunobelinus's son Caractacus took over and conquered the entire kingdom sometime after 40 AD. Dio Cassius records that Bericus, who was almost certainly Verica, was expelled from Britain around this time during a revolt. Suetonius refers to demands by the Britons that Rome return certain deserters. As Rex or King, Verica was nominally an ally of Rome, so his exile gave Claudius an excuse to begin his invasion in the summer of 1943, and the invasion targeted Caractacus's stronghold of Camulodunum, modern Colchester, previously the seat of his father Cunobelinus. And these deserters, these traitors, it had been discovered that they had helped Julius Caesar, basically. So they fled to Rome, and Britain was demanding that Rome hand back these traitors. And instead of handing them back, Claudius decided that what he was going to do was invade Britain again, basically. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
Other than the, I think the invasion by Julius Caesar took place on the south coast of England, and then they moved inland, and there was a very big battle at the River Medway, which is quite near Rochester, and the sort of local tribe that were involved in trying to repel the Romans was the Canti tribe, after which the county of Kent is named.
Yeah, they didn't get any further than that either. They you know, it certainly wasn't like conquering Britain. They basically made their way a little bit inland, not even past London, and then he was sent packing back to back to France, and I think we actually succeeded in taking one of his swords off him. There was a shield that had a sword in it that was on display in London for centuries, and it was Caesar's sword, and I think it forms part of the heraldry of the city of London. I'd have to revise on that, but there's quite an interesting story to do with that. But maybe that we'll talk about that another time with the Julian invasion. So we had the Roman invasion. This is the second time, and the Roman army did not want to go, though, remembering the beating they got the last time, saying, quote, "We will march anywhere in the Roman world, but not out of it." Close quote. Narcissus, the eunuch, a freeman and favourite minister of Claudius, was dispatched. For the first time ever, a eunuch climbed the general's tribune and addressed the Roman army, claiming that he himself would lead them into Britain. And this insult was enough to get the legions to change their mind and beg Plotius to take them where he wished. Aulus Plotius was the name of the general or the leader that was actually taking them. And they also had Vespasian and Titus with them, who also gained fame for fighting the war in Judea. So we were fighting against some pretty competent warriors, basically. If you think Vespasian and Titus were the ones that eventually took Jerusalem, and we were fighting against them in Britain before that actually happened. Well, Cunobelinus had died sometime before the invasion. Well, that's what Wikipedia tells us. The other reports tell us that he didn't actually die. He handed over the kingship to Caractacus, and he himself actually took a vow of peace, and he became an archdruid. And there's also histories that tell us that then he later on also became Christian. But there are reports that say that he stayed alive. And possibly the only reason why Wikipedia is saying that he had died is because they know that Caractacus was then king. But apparently he resigned, and this was some kind of a tradition that they had, which does make sense if you look at the Aryan Hindu traditions, when the warriors would renounce their fighting and they'd go off and live in the forest and become hermits and become peaceful. So it does actually tie in that there was this tradition and that the druids would have it. So Caractacus then became king, and he was then promoted to Pendragon. As I was saying, that we had to have a united leader of the tribes in Britain that directed the armies in these fights, and Caractacus led the initial defence of the country alongside his brother, Todgy Dumnus. I couldn't find much else about him apart from what was in Wikipedia. They led the initial defence of the country against Aulus Plotius's four legions, thought to have been around 40,000 men, primarily using guerrilla tactics, and he put up such a strong fight that reinforcements had to be called from Rome, which included the emperor himself and a cohort of elephants, which must have been quite a shocking sight here to see elephants. I should imagine maybe their waste might have scared the British horses as well, seeing a giant horse that size.
Yeah. I had no idea that the Romans did bring elephants to the UK. Actually, that's complete news to me. Yeah, that's a very interesting fact.
Yeah, I think it probably would have been, part of it would have been, you know, the smell of them and the size of them would have terrified the horses. With these extra troops against them, the British lost much of the southeast after being defeated in two crucial battles, the Battle of the River Medway and the Battle of the River Thames. The tribe of the Coritani also rebelled against Caractacus and joined the Romans. So we've got another traitor tribe here. Todgy Dumnus was killed, although John Hind argues that Dio was mistaken in reporting Todgy Dumnus's death, and that he was defeated but survived and was later appointed by the Romans as a friendly king over a number of territories, becoming the loyal king referred to by Tacitus as Codgy Dubnus or Todgy Dubnus. And the Catavellanian territories were conquered. Their stronghold of Camulodunum was then converted into the first Roman colony in Britain, the Colonia Victricensis. So he ends up losing his hereditary lands, and the Romans end up building their colony. And he's also suffered one of the tribes turning tail on him and joining the Romans. And it's interesting to hear that they say that his brother was actually made into a friendly king over a number of territories, and that sort of shows that after fighting, they would accept whoever it was that won the battle, and they would then become loyal to them rather than continuing to fight against them or having partisan warfare or anything like that. They would honour whatever their oath was and whoever it was that had the victory in battle. I mean, they say they had this battle here in the River Medway and the River Thames. Were you saying that was the same with the battle with Julius Caesar, the River Medway?
No, yes. Sorry, I was getting Caesar and Claudius mixed up earlier on. So the battle at Medway was against Claudius.
Yeah, I know they also put spikes in the Thames. I think that was in the battle with Julius Caesar, and apparently you could still see these metal spikes that they put in there at the turn of the last century. I don't know if they still can now, and that was to stop the boats making their way up there. And that, as I say, that was the first time of Julius Caesar, which I think was about 30 BC or something like that. Well, we next hear of Caractacus in Tacitus's Annals, leading the Silures and Ordovices of Wales against Plotius's successor as governor, Publius Ostorius Scapula. 32 battles are recorded as taking place between Caractacus and Vespasian, and they took place in Devonia. So they took place in Devon, according to Suetonius, and as Tacitus describes, the Silures reposed unbounded confidence in Caractacus, enumerating the many drawn battles he had fought with the Romans and the many victories he had obtained over them. So he was having a lot of success in fighting against these Romans, this formidable foe. And the final battle, legends place Caractacus's last stand at either Car Caradoc near Church Stretton or British camp in the Malvern Hills, but the description of Tacitus makes either unlikely. And Car Craddock is in Wales, as I say. I know somebody that's actually been there, and he says there's a lot of local history about Caractacus there, and that was actually the place of his last battle. So there must be evidence outside of the recorded histories that the battle actually took place there. But Tacitus's record of it says that Caractacus resorted to the ultimate hazard, adopting a place for battle so that entry, exit, everything would be unfavourable to us and, for the better, to his own men, with steep mountains all around, and wherever a gentle access was possible, he strewed rocks in front in the manner of a rampart, and in front too there flowed a stream with an unsure ford, and companies of armed men had taken up position along the defences. And that's the end of the quote there. But the fact that he's talking there about strewed rocks in front in the manner of a rampart, Car Caradoc, the fact that it has car in the name tends to say that there's something in the form of a cairn there. So there's probably some kind of a fort there that he actually set up. And that's also in North Wales. So he must have, the battles must have moved from Devon all the way up to North Wales. And if you think his original lands were Camlodunum or near Colchester, this shows you that he had the loyalty of the rest of the British tribes, because otherwise they would have been fighting against him. So he's basically manoeuvring around Britain, battling against the Romans. But Wikipedia says, although the Severn is visible from British camp, it is nowhere near it. So this battle must have taken place elsewhere. A number of locations have been suggested, including a site near Brampton Bryan. Barry Jones, in Archaeology Today in 1998, identified Blodwell Rocks at Llanymenec in Powys as representing a close fit with Tacitus's account. But I'm inclined to think it's probably... It was probably Car Caradoc, because why else would they give it that name? And as I say, yes, it's got these rocks there. Do you want?
I think initially the battles that Caractacus had, where he was leading the Silures who came from the southern part of Wales, slowly being beaten back, and he then retreated into North Wales, which is where the Ordovices lived, and so that would tend to suggest a more northerly location for this final battle, in my view. And as far as the Malvern Hills are concerned, I've been to the Malvern Hills on a few occasions, and from my recollection, there is no substantial river running close by them, although they are very steep hills. And they would, I think there was a hill fort on one of the peaks of the Malvern Hills in ancient times, but it probably would have been a very very secure place to make camp, etc. But that doesn't match the description, as you say, of the site.
Well, I mean, it talks about a stream. There flowed a stream with an unsure ford. And then the people that have been researching it have been saying, well, is that the Severn? But it seems to me that if it was just something like a small stream, then that could be lost over the, you know, over the flow of history. If it was just a small stream with a ford, because a ford is just something you can walk through, really. Yeah. It's something that doesn't even need a bridge. So if in Car Caradoc now they don't actually have a stream, then that could just be because of the flow of history, the march of time, basically. Well, I guess we should probably break here and continue with it next week, Max, with his capture and his speech. So thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require your donations to keep Radio Albion going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet for that purpose. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you, and of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.